Welcome back to Alternative Realities. I'm David Kelly, Chief Global Strategist here at JP Morgan Asset Management. For this episode, I'm excited to be joined by my colleague Ash Williams. Ash served as Chief Investment Officer and Executive Director for the Florida State Board of Administration, where he oversaw $250 billion in assets. His extensive experience as an institutional investor in both public and private markets. Today, we're going to discuss his approach to constructing a portfolio with alternatives. Well, Ash, thank you very much for being here.
Pleasure to be with you, David, as always.
Well, so to start off, can you share a little bit more with us about your background?
Yes, I've been in and around the asset management business for the better part of 50 years, and that has included, most significantly, probably a total of 20 years running the Florida State Board of Administration, which is a very large public pension fund. To give you an idea of what large means here, when I left at the end of the third quarter of 2021, we had $253 billion in assets. In addition to that public pension experience, I was the CEO of Schroeder Capital Management for the United States for a few years back in the mid-90s. I was also at a hedge fund for 9 years, which was an opportunistic value fund that worked across the asset classes, cap focus, et cetera.
Oh, so you've had a great tour as an investor and also a lot of insight into alternatives. Getting back to Florida and the portfolio managed, what were the sort of risk and return requirements and which asset classes could you invest in?
Well, we had complete flexibility for all asset classes. And part of the reason I was involved in this industry for so long is that way back when I was a senior in undergraduate school, I started working for the Florida House of Representatives. That led me to do a number of assignments for the Speaker of the House, who I later went to work for directly. And one of the first assignments I had was to look at the investment authority for the newly created Florida Retirement System, which at its inception was limited to government bonds and investment-grade corporates. Now, that fund was created in the early 1970s. So you had a period of very high inflation. The fund was underfunded structurally, so it was very young. There weren't people drawing benefits, but the likelihood that over time it could remain solvent and fiscally sound investing in government bonds and corporate investment grade, not great. So he was smart enough to recognize that. He asked me to look into it and come up with some recommendations for expanding the investment authority. So going back into the 1970s, the authority was expanded to include up to 25% of the portfolio in U.S. equity. The board took that authority, used it prudently, produced good results, and over ensuing years, we grew the authority, investment authority, to include global stocks, global bonds, hedge funds, alternatives, private equity, direct real estate, indirect real estate, et cetera, just about anything you could imagine. And the investment authority was all delegated to me. So there was not an operating investment committee like most public pension funds have. And we, again, unlike most funds, we had a substantial staff, a lot of investment professionals, and great external partners to execute through. So we got involved in lots and lots of things. And in terms of what our investment objectives were, we obviously were bound by an actuarial return assumption that was reset every year by the trustees of the pension fund. But I would say it ranged over the time I was there from a low of about 6.5% to a high of probably 8.5%. And I believe right now it's close to 7%. The national median of public pension fund actuarial return assumptions is 7%.
Mm-hmm. Okay, interesting. And so obviously you had, as part of this, you were adding alternatives to the portfolio. And I know you've been an advocate for having alternatives in portfolios, but both from an institutional investor perspective, but even from a high net worth individual investor perspective, why should investors consider putting money in alternatives?
Well, there are several good reasons, and one of them relates to a dimension of our return objectives in Florida that I failed to mention at first pass, and that is we looked at it in two dimensions. One is the actuarial return assumption. The second was to just simplify it. We thought, if we boil down this actuarial return assumption into a real return, for the long term, what would it look like? And our answer was a 4% real return. So that, from an investment standpoint, was really our North Star. And for individuals, it's a similar sort of a calculus. Mm-hmm. So if what you're thinking about is real return, and for taxable investors, real net return, net of fees and taxes, then as a very wise person once said, it's not what you make, it's what you keep. And that real return net number kind of gets you there. So why would one look at alternatives? I think traditionally it's two things at a minimum. It's diversification and it's alpha creation in the portfolio. And then you could add to that and say it's possible it could also, alternatives can also be a source of absolute return, which is an extension of the diversification concept. And finding an absolute return that's equal or greater than your 4% threshold is not as hard as it might sound.
Mm-hmm. So having said that, it's a vast arena of potential alternative investments, and the returns from different managers can be very different. So can you talk a little bit about when you're evaluating whether to add a particular alternative asset to a portfolio? What sort of process do you go through? And maybe you could walk through an example or two.
Sure. Well, I think it starts with what is the portfolio you begin with? Because any analysis of that sort starts at the margin. What do you have now? And what do you aspire to create? And do you have risks that you need to bound or diversify? Do you have gaps in your risk-seeking, alpha-gathering components of the portfolio that you would like to augment with other things? So that's maybe the framing I would start with. And then the next question would be, well, which of these alternative strategies, as you correctly point out, there are many, can I actually access? Many alternatives are somewhat walled off from potential investors by suitability issues, whether it's the size of the investment, many funds have minimums, for example, whether it is the time it would take you as an individual or an allocator, an institutional allocator, to build a properly diversified alternative portfolio. By the time you get done with manager diligence, structural negotiations, actually getting people hired, having capital called, having an investment period go by, having an exit period go by, having potential fund extensions at the discretion of the GP and potentially the LPs, having all of those expire, then getting distributions, then reinvesting that money in successive funds, it can take literally 30 years to structure an alternatives portfolio that's diversified and becomes self-funding through its own distributions. Individuals don't have that kind of a time frame unless they start when they're 20 years old, and very few people have the assets at age 20 to do that. And for that reason, there are constraints. So you have to look at what you can actually have access to. If you're an institution, that is a much more open-ended answer than it is if you're an individual. But some things that are technically considered alternatives are really quite mainstream: private equity, infrastructure, transportation infrastructure, timber. I mean, those are all alternatives, but they're not terrifically exotic in terms of what their strategies are. They don't bring particularly fearsome risk profiles, quite the opposite in some cases. But they're just considered alternatives. So it's all in what you need to do. And if you think of a portfolio that's anchored in public markets, oftentimes there are pockets of alpha that can be accessed, including relating to an illiquidity premium or transient opportunities that may be in the marketplace. As an example, back in the late 90s, early 2000s, in the run-up to the dot-com collapse and then the immediate aftermath of the dot-com collapse, I was at our hedge fund in those days, and we made an awful lot of money by buying shares by buying the outstanding debt of dot-com companies that frankly, in our view, were fake businesses, but they were current pay on their debt. Usually they would only have one debt issue outstanding. It would be senior to a market cap that could be $1 billion or more, even in a company that had never seen a profit. And in some cases, companies that had never even seen a sale, much less a profit. So there are opportunities there to buy debt with a current yield in the 25% plus ballpark, hedge your downside by shorting the equity. And the strategy was what we would call limp and live. If the thing survives 6 months paying that dividend yield, I've got my money out of it. Anything past that is pure profit. If it fails tomorrow, I'm going to get paid my principal from the equity short. And you can adjust the ratio of the short equity to the long credit appropriately for what your remaining exposure is. Or think forward to the more recent great financial crisis. We were among that small list of firms that were lucky enough or smart enough, not sure which, we'll take credit for both, to see the collapse coming in residential real estate. And so we were appropriately short through credit default swaps, a number of entities that made sense to be short if you anticipated failures coming in that space. And we made some very dramatically positive returns when there was an awful lot of misery in other parts of the market. And I loved making client calls around that period when people would be completely somber on the other end of the phone and say, well, how bad was it? Meaning the prior quarter. And if you could give them an answer like plus 40%, they would say, what, I must have misheard that. That's impossible. Everybody is suffering terribly. How could you possibly have made that kind of a return? And that was the answer. That was not a public market strategy. That was something that was creative. It used derivatives. It used a lot of on-the-ground research that reached its own conclusions about why we thought this thing was going to happen. And we were fortunate to have a number of LPs who had earned their net worth in the field of real estate, either residential or commercial. And we had the benefit of their thinking on the whole thing too, which was helpful.
I mean, it sounds like you've got to identify a theme, but two, you've got to have a clever way of implementing that theme in terms of security selection.
Correct. And for most institutions and for all individuals, these are not things you're going to be able to do yourselves. Now, at JP Morgan, obviously, our depth is such that there are very few things that are outside of our scope for execution or strategizing or conceptualization, but that's very much the exception.
Just briefly, do you think of alternatives differently, or what are the biggest differences in terms of dealing with an institution and dealing with an individual?
Well, you mean from the standpoint of an alternative investment professional?
In terms of what the role that alternatives can play in these portfolios. Sure. Think about what these investors are looking for.
Right. Well, I think the first thing is institutions, for the most part, have a wholly different investment horizon. Most institutions, if you think about pension funds, insurance companies, endowments, foundations, sovereign wealth funds, et cetera, they will have a virtually infinite horizon. So they're investing minimally over a 30 to 50 year horizon. That's not true of individuals because of a little problem known as mortality. I'm 70 years old today. So I would hesitate to enter an investment today that I thought had a 40 year horizon. That would be unbridled optimism on my part. So for individuals, I think there are real concerns about the longevity and illiquidity. Secondly, there are concerns about complexity. A lot of strategies people simply don't know about. They have no context for evaluating them. They have no capability to do diligence on the strategy, the underlying manager, what their track record is, how to interpret it, how to understand how the vectors of economic and geopolitical activity could affect that strategy over time. It's just not knowable for an individual. And then there's also generally an issue with higher fees, or potentially substantially higher fees, and a lack of transparency. Institutions are positioned to deal with all of those issues. And of course, one of the things that's going on today is that individuals are, in many cases, particularly the more sophisticated individual investors, attracted to alternatives because they see the value that institutions have found in alternatives and realized from inclusion of alternatives in portfolio construction over the past several decades. And they're envious, so they want to participate. But channels have to be created to allow access to this somewhat elite, don't try this at home class of investment opportunities known as alternatives. And I think the democratization of alternatives is one of the things that's going to happen with accelerating change over time.
Mm-hmm. So in previous episodes, we've talked a lot about the importance of manager selection. Can you, from your experience, can you give us some advice as to how people should approach that?
The most important thing is manager selection. The second most important thing is the manager selection. And the third most important thing is don't forget the first two. Mm-hmm. Manager selection is everything. Why? Because these strategies are often sufficiently idiosyncratic that the value add is in the mind of that GP or principal of your alternative partner that you're seeking to put capital with. It is also true that the character of that individual or firm, the integrity of the individuals, the honesty of the firm, the alignment that they are willing to create with you as an investor is rational and you can count on them. If you have misalignment, and even worse, if you have misalignment complicated by any lack of an absolutely dependable moral compass zeroed in on true north, that being the truth, you've got a problem and you don't want to be there.
Yep. Very, very wise advice. Okay. Well, one last question. Here we are in the fall of 2024. From this perspective, where do you see the most compelling opportunities and alternatives today?
Usually the best alternative or the best opportunities involving alternatives or any other investment area are found in places that are out of favor. And if you have the ability to look through the proverbial coal heap in search of diamonds and you find a few, then you're more likely to find those diamonds in the part of the coal heap where other people aren't coming through the same rubble you are. Well, what does that mean today? One asset class that has had its challenges in the post-COVID world is real estate. And of course, we just came out with new long-term capital market assumptions. And lo and behold, what topped the hit parade from the highest expected for the highest expected return among the asset classes over the next 10 to 15 year period? Value-added real estate at 9%. So if you think about that for a moment, here's an area that's out of favor. It's had capital outflows. There have been some real issues in the area, but fairly narrow issues involved in certain types of office real estate, I believe, have detrimentally affected the perception of all real estate. So I would commend that area to anyone to give a good look to. Another area that would be within the sphere of alternatives that makes some sense, I believe, is venture capital. Venture capital and private equity have in recent years seen a far lower level of distributions than they have in prior years. That has been an issue for many LPs and allocators to those areas simply because they need those distributions to continue making commitments in their programs to successive funds. And if they're not getting distributions, that means that new commitments either aren't going to happen, or they're going to be in a reduced scale, or they're going to be funded with money from some other part of the portfolio, which then raises the asset allocation and prudence question of, if I want to do more in private equity and venture, what am I going to sell that's appropriate within the risk return profile I'm trying to maintain? So that's an area that I think has some promise.
All right. Listen, thank you so much for joining us today, Ash, on your birthday with your insights.
Thank you very much. Been a pleasure. Take care.
This content is intended for information only based on assumptions and current market conditions and are subject to change. No warranty of accuracy is given. This content does not contain sufficient information to support investment decisions. It is not to be construed as research, legal, regulatory, tax, accounting, or investment advice. Investments involve risks. Investors should seek professional advice or make an independent evaluation before investing. The value of investments and the income from them may fluctuate, including loss of capital. Past performance and yield are not indicative of current or future results. Forecasts and estimates may or may not come to pass. J.P. Morgan Asset Management is the asset management business of J.P. Morgan Chase & Company and its affiliates worldwide.